In today's episode of the Neil Wilkins podcast, we are going to explore how to become a rock star speaker. Welcome to the show then, Steve.
Well, thanks for having me, Neil. Happy to help. Let's get started.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's get started, because so many people in my travels are struggling with this concept of speaking. It sounds so simple because every day we speak, we talk to our friends, we talk to our families and talk to our colleagues. But put us on a stage, put us in front of an audience, put us next to a screen, and then we just freeze. Why?
Well, there's a million reasons why. But here's the primary thing that I do. And this is what I try and encourage people to do. You know, that feeling of fear may never go away. And that's actually a good thing. You don't want it to go away. I've been on stage since the age of 6, which is like a million years ago. And every day when I get on a stage or on a screen or on a podcast, I don't identify it as fear anymore, but I get, you know, jitters, right? And it happens every single time. And I don't ever want that to go away. And the reason I don't want it to go away is because that's how I know I'm emotionally connected to the experience. And for me, speaking is not about a transference of information. Speaking is about a transference of emotion. My job as a speaker is not really just to inform you and teach you what I know, although that happens. But my primary job as a speaker is to get you to feel about my message the way I feel about my message. So it's a transference of emotion more than a transference of information. So with that being said, I need to be in an emotive state that gets me excited about the message. It gets me excited about what I'm doing, excited about serving, excited about the possibilities for my audience. And that means that I'm going to draw on those butterflies, you know, and the little bit of dry mouth and shaky knees and all those things that we get. I'm going to draw on that, and I want to turn it into positive energy so that I can have that emotional impact on my audience. And so the way we do that, the best way that I've ever learned to do that, is about changing the mindset. It's about changing the relationship with the nerves. And here's what I mean by that. So many people are very self-conscious in front of an audience or in front of a camera, and that's why they get all the nerves. What if they don't like me? What if I look bad? What if I fumble? What if I say the wrong thing? You know, what if it ends up on YouTube and it ends up destroying my career? You know, what if I really screw it up? These are all very self-conscious thoughts. And so all that does is exacerbate the negative energy and the stressful energy. But if we can put ourselves in a mindset of service instead, then, you know, and the mindset is, how can I serve this audience? How can I help this audience? What can I do to be of the most possible value to this audience? Then it redirects the energy. It doesn't get rid of the nerves, but it redirects them into a positive direction. So now you can draw on that energy. You can draw on that excitement. You can draw on those nerves, and you can be expressive and you can be emotive. And now you can transfer the emotional content of your message more than just the intellectual content of your message. So that's kind of why it happens. Usually it's a self-conscious thing, but it can be used. We can capitalize on it.
So I want to go deep into many of these things really kind of help, I guess, those of us who are a little less confident in this whole speaking idea in just a while. But I'm also very, very interested in the backstory, Steve. I mean, for those who haven't heard you talk and haven't read the book and seen your work to this point, can you give us a little bit of a step back in time? Because it would be very interesting to know kind of when you found out that this was your thing.
Sure. Yeah, I can take you back there. So I'll take you back to when I'm 6 years old. Now, I'm going to make this short because there's a lot of years between 6 years old and today. Okay. And you don't have a whole lot of time for an autobiography. But here's basically the way this happened. When I was 6 years old, I learned how to play the guitar. My father was a great guitar player. He taught me. And I was a bit of a, I wouldn't say a prodigy, but I was pretty young to be playing a guitar as well as I could play it. And so I loved to be in front of the school, my classmates. When I was 6 years old, I did a little local TV show. By the time I was in my teens, I had my own band and we were playing around town, you know. And then in my later teens, I was a professional musician, traveling the country, making records. You remember the black records, the little black 45 records? We made those. But the thing is, I was the front man in the band and the lead guitar player, but I was never the singer. And so the other guys were doing the singing. I did some oohs and ahs in the background, but I was the front man. So I was the one engaging with the audiences. I was the one cracking the jokes. I was the one taking all the heckling, all of that stuff that you do in the band. So in my early 20s, you know, the band fell apart. And so I started to do a solo thing, and it was just me, the guitar, and I would sing. And this is what I tell people, Neil, this is how I get in the speaking business. People would be in the pubs and the bars where I'm playing and singing. They would hear me sing and they would come up and they'd say, you know, Steve, maybe you should just say the words. And so, and so I put the singing aside and became a speaker. Now, but here's what actually happened is during that time, I stumbled across a video of Zig Ziglar. And I never knew Zig Ziglar existed. It never occurred to me that anybody could stand on a stage, say stuff, and make a career out of it. And I thought, this is the most amazing thing. Here's this guy. He's on the stage. He doesn't have any musical equipment. He doesn't have any bandmates that to argue with. None of his bandmates are doing drugs. His audience isn't drunk. I mean, I want to do that. So I started to pursue that. I joined an organization called the Dale Carnegie Training Organization. And at that time, it was one of the biggest training organizations in the world. And I took all of their courses. I wanted to learn the art of speaking professionally. I wanted to learn all of those things. And then what would happen is I was working for the company. So whenever there was a class, I'd be sitting at the back as what was called a graduate assistant. So I'm assisting the instructors. And in my mind, I'm coaching the people as they're coming up, the participants. And I'm listening to the instructors. And what's happening in my mind is I'm thinking, oh, I wouldn't have done it that way. Oh, that was good. I liked that. Oh, I would have done it this other way. I'm coaching them in my mind. Did that for a long time. And then one day, the instructor came to me and he said, Steve, would you like to try coaching somebody? And I said, yes, I would. So I went up. And the guy that I was coaching was like the scariest guy in the whole class. He was big, he was ugly, he was smelly, he was mean, and he didn't want to be there. His boss sent him there to learn some, you know, some basic human principles, right? He was nasty. And this was, I think, about week 5 in a 13-week program. So that's the student I got. And within about 3 minutes, I had that guy opened right up. And all of that negative energy melted away and the real him came out and he started to speak right from the heart and he never went back. He never went back to the previous thing. So for the rest of the program, he was like a stellar student. So, and at that moment, I had this sort of awareness where I said, I can do this. This I can do. I'm good at this. And so I built a career out of it. And what happened is I got trained to become an instructor with Dale Carnegie. But I actually didn't believe in a lot of the things that they were teaching at the time. And to become a Carnegie instructor, you have to do things the Carnegie way, which of course makes sense. So I couldn't sign the contract. I went through all the training. I was, you know, about to be certified, signed the contract, and I couldn't sign it. And so I just politely declined. I said, I cannot in good conscience do this because I don't believe in a lot of the ways you're teaching people to speak. And I didn't know why I didn't believe them. They just didn't feel right. They just didn't sit right. So I went on to start my own business and I became, you know, a speaker. I was speaking and coaching speakers. And so, you know, as far as being a speaker, you know, I'm an okay speaker. I can speak anywhere. I've spoken all over the world, you know, a million times and I'm fine as a speaker. And you know, I'm a good speaker, but nothing like I am a coach. I can take people and I can put them on a stage in front of an audience and I can pull magic out of them they never knew existed. That's my gift. So I've been cultivating that now for the last 40 years. And that's kind of what I do. I speak at events. I hold my own events and I bring people up onto the stage with me, people who claim to be, you know, paralyzed and mortified and, you know, all those things. And I just pull magic out of them they never knew existed. And so that's the story.
I love that part of the story where you were sitting at the back and really kind of listening and sort of internally coaching others to kind of almost sort of ply your trade, but within yourself. That's fascinating. And it just feels like then it becomes really part of you? I mean, clearly it was in your DNA in the way you're describing it. This was an innate skill that you and a preference that you had. But the way that you were kind of crafting that skill almost in private, but it wasn't because it was in public with people, that must have felt really good and really quite empowering. Every time you're doing it, you just feel like you're getting stronger and stronger, kind of sharpening that sword, so to speak.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, back then it was frustrating, right? Because I would be thinking about, you know, if I'm in my head, I'm watching the instructor and I would be thinking, do it this way, do it this way. Ask this question, ask them to do this. And of course, the instructor would do something else. And I would go, oh, they should have done it this other way. So when I had an opportunity to do it, I did what just came naturally and it worked really well. But where it becomes very beautiful is as I, you know, built this career and I've worked with so many people, where it becomes really great is where I take somebody who is literally too afraid to say their own name. And, you know, 5 years later, they're a $1 million speaker or, you know, a CEO who can't stand up and give, you know, speak at the annual general meeting of his company. And all of a sudden he can do a really great presentation to stakeholders and to staff and whoever. So when I see somebody who lets a lack of skill, a lack of, you know, this overabundance of fear, all this self-conscious belief, when I see them get over that and then they can just do magic themselves for an audience, that's the beautiful part, because it literally does change a lot of their lives. But even more importantly than that, Neil, is it changes the lives of those that they now affect and that they now inspire. So I've always believed that, you know, I used to have this mantra, it says, your story could change lives. And I have a lot of clients from all over the world who have big stories, you know, of all types. And some of those stories really can and do change lives, but they'll never change lives if they're never told. And so to let people, you know, I can't have people not at least try to get over that fear when they have something inside them that needs to be shared with the world.
I want to come on to that kind of passion and speaking from the heart in just a moment. But do you see in your work, and I guess because you're talking to so many different people at many different levels, many different industries, nationalities, cultures, you know, this is a very, very broad kind of remit, I guess, that you're working with here. Do you see very specific patterns? I mean, we've talked there about fear. We've talked there about kind of this sort of, you know, paralyzing of, you know, the physicality of, you know, when you stand on a stage or you're in front of an audience and suddenly you are literally paralyzed and not able to kind of even breathe or kind of think clearly. Do you see patterns of this kind of emerging in individuals more generally? Are there certain things almost to look out for if you are that speaker? Are there things to kind of really just be really aware of?
Yeah. So, yes. So when somebody comes to me, and if they're at that level, I don't work with them anymore. I refer them to somebody else, because that's not the level that I work at anymore. I work at a much more professional level now, where people come and this is time for them to monetize their message, right? But with the people who are at the state that you're speaking about, there is a pattern. And the pattern is this. The pattern is two things. Number one is there are two things that tend to keep people stuck in that state. One of them I've already mentioned is the mindset of service. The other one is the mindset of allowance, which means, what I mean by that is they need to learn to allow themselves to come out and sort of violate the protection mechanisms that they have in front of them. They have to breach the armor from within. And that's not that difficult to do. It's a mindset thing. And you need to think about, I'm just going to allow myself to be me. And in being me without the armor and without all of the self-conscious concerns, then I can help people. If I hide behind my armor, I can't be me. I can't be in a position of service and I can't help people. So once they do it once they feel what it's like to be disarmed once, and they feel what it's like to be in that mindset of allowance just once and just for a few seconds, they get it. And now they know how to do it. And that, so it doesn't take months and months and months of training. It can take years of training if you don't allow yourself to be, authentically expressive. So what I do with people that come in at that level, I usually recommend Toastmasters, because Toastmasters, it's all over the world. It's very inexpensive. It's non-threatening. And it is very good at giving people space to make that allowance happen, over time. But, my work is not at that level anymore. My work is at a much, much more, higher professional money-making kind of level now. But that is definitely the pattern. The people that are so afraid that let themselves become paralyzed, it's usually a matter of A, they're not in a mindset of service, and B, they're not in a mindset of allowance. You've got to allow it, and then you've got to allow it to be in service.
So I've become vulnerable. I've allowed it. I've experienced that, I guess, both emotional but also thoughtful situation then that emerges. So that kind of that outcome of, oh my goodness, now I've got the audience. I've got them listening to me. They're starting to pay attention. I'm starting to feel good. I'm starting to feel, okay, it is a bit of a monologue, but it's kind of feeling a bit more like a conversation now. So I've got their attention. Where does, say, for example, then the CEO that you've just described as, they're doing their annual general meeting, they're standing up, it's a big audience. Where does this kind of balance between that vulnerability and that real openness come in then, when you have to balance that with, oh, but I've actually got a really serious message to talk about here. So yeah. I've actually got maybe shareholders, I've maybe got journalists here. If I'm a big corporate, I've got, I've got the media here probably waiting for my, my little slip up. Where does kind of vulnerability and transparency then balance with that? Because that's quite a sensitive balance to strike, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a sensitive balance to strike, and it all goes back to a mindset of service. So here's the thing. If you're in front of an audience telling your touching story about your life, the best way you can be in service is to be vulnerable and to be as authentic as you can. If you're standing in front of a room of stakeholders, the best way to be in service is to be professional, articulate, concise, and precise. So the concept is the same. How are you best going to be in service to that audience? And not always is being emotionally vulnerable in service to the audience. This is why it's so important to understand, how can I best serve this audience? Who do I have to be to serve this audience? So if I'm the CEO and I'm speaking to investors and I'm speaking to stakeholders and I'm speaking to staff, if I break down and cry, that's not going to serve them. What's going to serve them? They need to see confidence. They need to see authority. They need to see empowerment. They need to see, they need to be able to look at me as a leader, somebody that they can trust. So who do I have to be in order to make that happen? And so that's the person I will put forth. If I'm trying to get somebody to buy into an idea, then who do I have to be to get them to buy into this idea? How do I serve them? If I'm trying to get somebody to hire me as their coach, who do I have to be to serve them towards that outcome? So it all comes to, who do I have to be and who do I have to allow myself to be to serve that audience?
And I suppose that it's that service that keeps it authentic, because without that level of service, being a different person almost feels like it's faking it, doesn't it? But with the service angle to it, it feels there's the authenticity, because ultimately it's where's the value to the audience, as opposed to, oh, right, so you've got this one audience, so you're being this person. Now you're talking to these guys over here, and now you've suddenly changed. It's almost like you're a different person. But because of that level of service, it's okay, isn't it?
Sure, of course, everybody does. I mean, imagine, you, for example, you are one person here, right? This is, Neil, the podcast host, and this is who you need to be to best serve your audience, right? But let's say now after the podcast, you and I go down to the pub and slam back a couple of beers, okay? My guess is you're not quite the same Neil. I can tell you, I'm not the same Steve, but they're both authentic expressions of the way we need to serve our audience, whoever that audience is. So the CEO who has to be very stoic and who has to be very controlled and has to be very authoritative and has to be a leader can be the same person who can go out that evening with his buddies and just crack jokes and have a great time. Doesn't mean it's two different people. It's two different ways to serve the audience. Right. And so all of them are authentic. And authenticity is another it's another word I think that is highly misused or misunderstood, especially in the speaking business. You know, there's a big, you know, a big thing about always be authentic, always be authentic. Well, I don't necessarily agree with that. And I'll tell you why. I'll give you an example. I'll take you back to when I was playing music, right? When I was in the band, I was playing music in the bars. And I don't know if you're familiar with the song Brown Eyed Girl. You know that old song, Brown Eyed? Everybody knows that song. I can't tell you how many thousands of times we've played that song, Brown Eyed Girl. And as a musician, yeah, it's a fun song, but as a musician, it's got three chords. It requires zero talent, zero ability, zero creativity. There's just nothing to do with that song but sing it. And so every time that we had to play that song, in my mind, if I was being authentic, I would be saying, I don't want to play this stupid song again. I've done it four times tonight already. That would be my authenticity, right? But of course, we can't do that. So we put ourselves in a position of service. So my job back then as a musician and as the person singing that particular song, which was like one of the two songs I could sing, my job was to make this audience feel like it's the first time I've ever done it. Right. I need to make this audience feel like this is one of the most, you know, best experiences of my life, because I want to make it one of the best experiences of theirs. Like, that's the mindset. So what do? We don't necessarily always express our authentic feelings at the time. What we sometimes have to do is we have to create a little bit of theater because we have an authentic passion for our craft. So does that mean that when I'm bopping around singing that song, look like I'm having a great time, I'm being inauthentic? No, I'm not being inauthentic. What I'm doing is I'm expressing my authentic passion for my craft, even though I hate the song, right? So what that means is that you can be, you can be that fun-loving speaker that makes everybody laugh and maybe crack some off-color jokes. You can do that. You can also be the stoic CEO that has to perform in a very professional manner. You can be the emotional person who is going to, you know, try to inspire the troops with an emotional story. And you can still be, you can be all of those things and still be authentic. And it's just a matter of putting on whatever, it's not an act, but bringing forth the part of you that is in best service of that audience.
So the little bit of theater then that you've used there, I'll paraphrase your quote there that you said, sure. How does that kind of manifest? I mean, if I'm in front of maybe a client and, I've got a room full of people, maybe there's a dozen people, and I'm presenting some reports and I'm suggesting, you know, next steps in a particular project or something like that, what kind of things would I be doing to bring theater to play there?
Right. So in a formal presentation, depending, again, it depends on how you're going to best serve this audience. And if it's a situation where theater is not in alignment with how you serve that audience, then don't bring it in. So the CEO who's presenting, you know, the really crappy quarterly reports to the shareholders is not likely going to engage a whole lot of theater. But if you are an inspiring speaker, if you're trying to tell a story, you're trying to motivate people, inspire people, you're trying to create some influence, change a mindset, rattle a belief system, change their expectations on something, reset their paradigms, then that takes an emotional context. The audience needs to know what the emotional context is. So in order to do that, sometimes you have to reach in and you have to put a little bit of theater into the emotion. Just like if I'm playing Brown Eyed Girl, I'm putting theater into the delivery to express what the emotional context is supposed to be for the audience, even if I don't feel it. So sometimes we have to engage a little bit of theater to make sure that the audience receives the proper emotional context. Otherwise, I'm not serving the audience. I'll give you another example. I had a motorcycle accident about 15 years ago. Nothing dramatic. I fractured three ribs, bruised myself up a bit. But the next day, I had to speak. I was a keynote speaker at an event. I was on painkillers. I hadn't slept. Every bone in my body ached. Could barely breathe because my ribs were fractured. I mean, I was a mess. There was no damage to this. So other than, you know, my feeling all about it, you couldn't tell. So if I was being authentic with that group, I would have gone out there and I just would have said, I don't want to be here. I need to be in bed. I feel awful. Let's just get through this stupid thing. Like, that's the way I was feeling. But I need to be in service to that audience. And I couldn't stand. I couldn't stand for a long time. So what I did was I took a stool, like a bar stool. And I had them bring that out, and I just sat on the stool and I gave a great talk, and you could not tell that I was injured or that I wasn't feeling great, because you invoke the theater to the extent that it serves your audience. And sometimes that just happens. And that's a skill that we have to develop. When do you invoke theater and when do you not? And this is another problem for a lot of fledgling speakers is, you know, you were talking about a lot of people, they get frozen, right? They get paralyzed and they don't know what to do. There are just as many people who do the exact opposite, and they use theater to compensate for the fear. And what you get is all theater. And I call it meaningless stylization, where they're too big, they're too theatrical, they're too stylized, and none of it is real. So part of the skill of being a good speaker is to be able to balance your authentic self-expression with the theater to express your authentic passion for your craft in service of the audience. And that's the skill that takes some time to develop.
There's something called the law of, and I've got to be careful how I say this because I always get this wrong. It's a tricky word to say, reciprocity. Mm-hmm. The law of reciprocity, the reciprocal mm-hmm. behaviors that you get back. I'm guessing this thing plays out here. So if I come to speak to an audience, and maybe it's, you know, a few hundred people, it's a big auditorium, and you know, there's a lot of faces looking at me. I am going to get, this is a rhetorical question, but actually probably is a real question. I'm going to get back what I put out. So if I come into this quite dour, quite monotone, quite predictable, I'm going to get that response back. If I come at this with real passion and really speaking from my truth and from my heart, I'm going to hook in, maybe not everybody in the audience, but the vast majority, aren't I? Am I going to get that kind of mirror effect, as I call it?
Yes, with a caveat. So I'll give you an example, and this will explain what I mean. And I see this all the time with speakers who are not as skilled as they could be yet. Sometimes a speaker will come out and they will blast out onto the stage. Whoa, look at me. And they'll come out with music and they'll come out dancing and they're screaming and they get the audience up dancing and all that kind of stuff. And they think that's a good thing. And sometimes it is a good thing, but 90% of the time it's not. So here's the caveat, and I'll give you the example. One time I was speaking to a large group, and it was 7 a.m., 7 o'clock in the morning. It's a business group. And, you know, they had just, you know, gotten in from the night before, and I'm thinking some of them were kind of out, you know, the night before. And so I came out, and part of my job as the opening keynote speaker is to do that, to get them excited about the day. Now, I don't come out yelling and screaming and jumping, and I don't do that, but I can be reasonably high energy, and I'm usually pretty good at, you know, where should I come in? I'll check the room and kind of get a sense of temperature, so to speak, and I try and gauge the energy level with which I should come out. Well, I misgauged this one, and I came out way too energetic, which means they were kind of here, and I was way up here. Now, there is a fundamental principle that says your audience will never rise above you in energy. But, and so my, you know, what we would think is if I'm energetic, I'll pull them up, but it wasn't happening. So here's what I'd had to do. Had to realize this. When you're going to maneuver an audience through the energetic states, it's kind of like the old Western movies. Remember when the bad guys on the horses would rob a train in the Western movies, right? What would they do? They never come against the train and try and jump on. They get the horses to run alongside the train, match the speed of the train, then they would jump on the train. And it's kind of similar with an audience. If I'm here and the audience is here and we stay that way, I'm kind of going against the train. My job is to come down and get with them and then bring them up with me. So what I had to do was I had to slow down, bring the temperature down, bring my speed down. And I would look at certain people in the audience as I'm speaking. I would, you know, I'd nod. I'd get some people nodding. Okay, now I'm on the same level. I'm on the same speed as the train. Get enough people nodding. Okay, and now I pick it up a little bit, and I bring the audience up with me. And that way now, you know, we're always on the same page. Because oftentimes you're so correct. If the audience is here and I come out here, we're not on the same page. Similarly, if the audience is here and I come out here, we're not on the same page. So what you and I need to do as speakers is we need to find the audience wherever they are. We need to meet them either come down to meet them or come up to meet them. And then if we choose, we want to bring them up with us. So it's not like we're on top and we reach down and grab them and pull them up. We need to get at their level and then bring them up. And again, that takes some skill. That takes some, you know, some tenure to learn how to do that.
That isn't something that you do on your very first outing, is it? I mean, this is something that requires you to kind of be listening at the same time as speaking. Do you find you go into, let's call it an alternate state when you're actually talking? So you might either have a script or you have this narrative story kind of inside you that you think, okay, I know what I'm going to say. I don't quite know exactly when and how I'm going to say it, but I know I'm almost, and I'll use the phrase, I'm going to be on autopilot to a certain extent, because then that opens up and allows you to be sensing the room, watching those nods, actually making those connections, if you like. Is that for you when you do it? Is that a conscious thing, or does it just happen?
So the answer is both. So here's the concept you're talking about. This is what I teach speakers, this concept, and it's probably one of the most important concepts. You need to go through your content until your content comes through you. Now, let me explain what that means. Memorizing and reciting a script is not going through your content until your content comes through you. So many speakers memorize and recite a script, and it's not that that's a mistake. The problem with that is you're speaking from here, and all you're doing is reciting words and then maybe putting a little bit of artistry and theater to accentuate some of the points. But none of it is a transference of emotion. It's all a transference of information. It's the saying of the words, right? With some articulation and some hand movements. When you go through your content till your content comes through you, it means that you may say the same exact thing every single time. You may say it exactly the same way. You may gesture precisely the same way. You may be able to take two presentations, put them on top of each other. They will be exactly the same, but that doesn't mean it's memorized and recited. The difference is that one of them comes through the mind, the other comes through the soul. So when you go through your content till your content comes through you, it comes from here. That way you don't have to memorize anything. So when I speak, I've got, what I do is I break up all my talks into little mini modules. So little mini 2 or 3 minute talks, and they all kind of connect. So when I'm out there, I can pick the modules that I want at any given time. When I was playing music, one of the things I got really good at was reading the audience. You know, I'd be in the front of the band and I'm watching the audience to see how they're responding to this song. And then based on their response, I would decide the next song. I would just yell it back to our drummer. He counted in and we would do the next one. But the song I do next was always dependent on how the audience is responding to this one. So it's similar to me as a speaker. When I go out, yeah, I have a set agenda ready to go. But because I know my content so well, I can adjust it on the fly anytime I want. I'm not winging it. That's another big, big, big mistake, is thinking you can wing it. You can't. Nobody can properly. But if you know, that's not winging it. I know my content so well that I can pick and choose what mini module I'm going to use at any given time. Right. And so it is very much about reading the audience. I get as much information from the audience as they get from me. Where that becomes difficult is if it's a large place and there are lights and I can only see the front row, and maybe not even that, then it's a little more difficult to judge. So I got to listen. I've got to listen for what, you know, to and grab whatever information I can from there. But you're 100% correct. What I deliver and how I deliver it is very much dependent on the receptiveness of the audience in that given moment. And again, that's another one of the skills that takes time to develop.
How do you deal if this does happen? And I guess in professional senses, it's kind of quite rare, but certainly in a music sense, it will have happened many times, I'm sure. How do you deal with hecklers, somebody in the audience who's kind of there to disrupt, and every module that you've got that you're picking from just doesn't seem to be really appeasing them, and they're just constantly hitting back at you? And of course, then they're gaining maybe a little bit of support in the audience, and maybe it's amusing for the audience. And then it's almost like you're kind of under the spotlight. Okay, how's he going to cope now? How do you deal with the heckler?
Yeah. So first of all, you're right. In the professional space, it hardly ever happens. Very, very, very rarely do I get a heckler in the audience. I do have an advantage, though, because all those years playing music in biker bars, we had our fair share of hecklers. So I got really good at handling hecklers. Again, that's a skill you develop, and not many speakers need to develop that skill, because I don't know that it's ever happened on the professional stage. I think maybe one time, and it wasn't a heckler as much as I said something like this. I called the audience, you guys, or okay, guys, like something like that. And some lady in the audience yelled out, don't call us guys. And so all I did was I did this. I said, okay, let's take a poll in the audience. Put up your hand if it offends you if I say you guys. And, you know, no hands went up except for hers. And I said, okay, you can stay or not stay. It's totally up to you. Okay, guys, let's go. And right. And so I did that. But that's the only heckler I can think of. There's very rarely, that may be in all the years I've been speaking professionally, and there's been 40. I think that may be the only one I can remember where there was one other one, Neil. Now this one, this one I deserved. Okay. So I'll tell you this one. So I was speaking at an event. It was a networking event, a large networking event. There was, well, I don't know, a large 150 people maybe. And I was the keynote speaker, but there was no stage and there were no seats. And so what happened was, when it came time for me to speak, they cleared a little area on the floor. They gave me a microphone and everybody was standing. Okay. So the only people who could see me were the ones that were standing right here, you know, because I'm not a tall guy. So I made the mistake, you know, have you ever had, Neil, one of those, it seemed like a good idea at the time kind of moments?
Too many, right?
Those, well, yeah. This was one, because I'm always teaching my speakers, you know, do not open with a joke unless you know it's been tried and tested and true, right? Don't wing it on a joke after your first line. So, you know, I broke the cardinal rule. And what I said was, well, you know, this is great, because usually people don't stand until after I finish speaking. And there was crickets, not a sound, except one guy way in the back. He goes, ha, ha, ha.
Ouch. You know you're in trouble. When.
Yeah, I know I'm in trouble. So that one, you know, I recovered, of course, but it was very, very humbling. But really, the audiences, Neil, they don't want you to fail. They want you to succeed. They're rooting for you. And if there is a heckler, and I don't know that there's been any more, but if they're, you know, I'm speaking, what day is today? I'm speaking in 2 days in Phoenix. And if there is a heckler, here's my mindset on hecklers. That's it. That's my mindset. Just shrug it off. Forget it. Because anytime there's a heckler or somebody who deliberately tries to derail you, everybody in that audience knows they look like an idiot. Everybody. So, and really, it's not a problem. It just never really happens.
How do you use something like silence, that pause, that moment where, you know, we know speakers, we all kind of know either somebody personally, or you've seen somebody, you know, on television or in the movies or whatever, and they just use silence to perfection. They hold that moment in time, that space between what they're saying. I mean, some of the most, you know, incredible orators of all time, Martin Luther King, for example, you know, a lot of people think Barack Obama, you know, and some of the key speeches that he made, whether you agree with the politics or not, right, is irrelevant, just as a speaker. The use of the pause, the use of space, that kind of confidence to be able to not say anything, but you're saying everything. How does one kind of either master that or even experiment with that? Because that requires a lot of confidence, doesn't it?
Yeah. You know, silence can be very intriguing to an audience. And of course, you know, you caught that I was doing that, right? I mean, you caught that.
I did yeah. Spot that one, yeah.
You did spot that. Well, you're a bright
just
guy.
That
you know?
Just that moment, yeah.
Yeah, just that moment, yeah, sure. So, yes, the thing about silence is almost like another word, right? Like it can be very, very, very powerful. The only thing that makes it difficult is self-consciousness. Because what happens is, when I'm silent, it feels like an eternity to me, and it feels like a millisecond to you. So when I'm coaching my clients, we strategically plan silences So that when it's coming up in their talk, they know when to do it. And I coach them how long to do it. And in every single case, they really struggle to keep it that long. And it doesn't have to be long. Silence can be 3 seconds. And it's very powerful. And so it is a difficult thing to master, but it's just being able to tolerate that silence. It's like anything else, you know, when you're being expressive on a stage, sometimes it feels like it's a 4 to you and it's a 0 for the audience. Sometimes it feels like it's a 10 for you, like, oh, I'm going way over the top. And the audience is going, no, that sounds about right. So if it's a 10 for me, it's about a 4 for them. And so silence is kind of the same. If it feels like an hour for me, it's probably about 5 seconds or less for them. And so we just have to be aware of that. So I start by helping them understand it. If this part of your talk, leave that silence for this amount of time and count to this in your head, and they'll do that deliberately for 3-4 times, then they get it. Then they start to understand what the silence is and where to place it. But yeah, you're right. Powerful tool.
I mean, there are just so many facets to this, aren't there? But I keep coming back and I keep hearing your words where you said it's about the passion. It's about talking from the heart. It's about really kind of feeling it, because that is what your audience is going to take away. Because it never is the detail, is it? It's never the words, really. It is the passion and the energy that comes through. Is that the single most important thing when speaking?
Well, again, it depends. My initial answer is yes, but that's in my world as a speaker. But it's not always the case if it's a formal presentation. Like, you were talking about the CEO. So there are presentations where the information is the thing. So I have clients who are financial planners, for example, and they say to me, Steve, my clients don't want me to be emotionally. They don't want to make decisions based on emotion. They want the facts, the figures, the numbers, the statistics, the science, and that's it. Okay, that's fair. That is a formal business presentation where the purpose is to transfer information and answer questions and give clarity. That is, and so you don't want to be emotive there. It's not about transference of emotion. But that's not really the kind of speaking I'm talking about. I'm talking about, you know, you and I, coaches, trainers, authors, consultants, experts, thought leaders who have, you know, spent an entire career amassing this wisdom, this knowledge, these ideas, this intellectual property, these creative thoughts. And now it's time to share them with the world in a much bigger way. That's where the emotion piece really comes in. And do the words matter? Of course, yes. The words absolutely matter. The information does matter. But here's the words matter to the extent that they provide understanding. The emotion is what provides the importance. And if it was just the words, send me a PDF. I'll take it to the bathroom and read it, and I don't need you. That's how important the words are. They are important, but they're not important enough for me to need a speaker.
I want to push people towards the book, Steve, because, sure, you know, we were talking earlier about some of the resources and things that you've made available to people. And, you know, the wisdom that everybody listening to this, the wisdom that Steve has and the experience and the depth of those little nuances, those little things you didn't even realize were things, come through loud and clear in Steve's book and a lot of the teaching that he does. So, Steve, where can people kind of get hold of these assets and these resources?
Well, they can go to my website at stevelowell.com. Everything is there. But for your audience, I want to give them a complimentary copy of my first book, From Stage Fright to Spotlight. I wrote this back in 2011, 99 Speaker Secrets to Breaking the Rules and Mastering the Stage. And it's cool because you can open it up on any page and there's something there to read. There are tips and techniques and tricks on every single page. So it's all little mini bites. And there's one in there. In fact, my wife was just asking me just before this meeting, we were talking about this book in a different context. And she said, what's your favorite point in the book? And my favorite point in the book, and if you're listening to this and you like to find it, I don't know what page it's on, but it's a concept called intermittent incongruity, And there's a story in there about a beautiful young lawyer, female lawyer, who starts to disrobe while she's speaking. And you're going to want to read about that in there because it's very interesting.
And there we go. If that's not a
there we go. To,
and we said it's about the passion, but it's also about the words. I think it was about the words there, because there's a certain curiosity I have now to finding those pages.
Yeah.
We'll see where that goes. Steve, this has been an absolute pleasure. And thank you so much for all the guidance and wisdom here. For me, it's been really interesting to kind of separate out those different types of talks, that different kind of speaking that all of us as business professionals have those certain moments where it's different, but actually separating out what is appropriate in those moments, I think is so key. So thank you so much for clarifying that. It's been a real pleasure talking.
Well, thank you for asking and thanks for having me. And it has been great. You know, we were talking earlier, you and I, Neil, and, you know, I've been on a lot of podcasts and you know, I just love meeting the people. I love serving the audience, but I have to say you're a really good host. You ask great questions. You keep the conversation going. You make it easy for me. So thank you for that.
Oh, you're very welcome. And thank you for the kind words. It's very much appreciated, because as a host, you never really know kind of how it's going, how the guest is feeling. So thank you. Thank you so much. That's great.